Shalom, shalom, damn it, this is Rabbi Sol Solomon here on UNC Radio on the Dave's Gone By Radio program. We just heard a little bit of the musical group The Kinks doing their song Celluloid Heroes, and that, it isn't all it's cracked up to be necessarily, the fame and the fortune and the wealth. I certainly wish I could find that out for myself. I would like to know about it personally rather than reading about their terrible troubles. Because if you gave me a lot of money, I would buy houses, I would buy a steak in the Carnegie Deli, and that would be about it. You know, the rest I would save for my many, many, many upcoming grandchildren. But the main thing that I want to talk with you here today on Dave's Gone By is about a new book. It's a book about Hollywood movie stars, the kind of people that the Kinks were just talking about. Folks like Marlon Brando, and Walt Disney, and Buster Keaton, and Charlie Chaplin, and so many people who had these amazing lives and these amazing stories to go with their lives. These funny, wild, zany, bizarre anecdotes. And who better to share these anecdotes than the person who is on the telephone with me right now, I hope, if the phone is working. His name is Stephen Shohet, and he's written this book called Hollywood Stories, short entertaining anecdotes about the stars and legends of the movies. It's from Hollywood Stories Publishing. You can get it at hollywoodstories.com. And if you're sitting on the fence, you're like, I don't know, do I need another book? Do I really need to read these stories? Well, our conversation with Stephen Shohet should help get you off the fence and buying that book to read these stories, because he's going to tell us some right now. So, Stephen Shohet, happy High Holy Days to you. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Rabbi. Thank you. Same to you.
Oh, and you sound wonderful. I guess you can hear me and I can hear you. This is going to... We're already rolling. But my first question for you is about your last name. You pronounce it Shohet. Is that because the Goyim can't pronounce a ch?
Well, it's because that's the way my parents were pronouncing it. So I just continued with that, I guess. But yeah, it's always been a difficult name to pronounce, and I always had a lot of mangling of it when I went to school.
Well, you know what your name means in Hebrew,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, it's
Butcher.
High Holy Days, the Shoheds, I think they slaughtered the chickens, actually.
Not just on the High Holy Days. A Shohet is a slaughterer, a butcher.
And yeah, so, butcher, yeah.
Do you do a hack job on the stars that you write about? I don't think so. But
what was that?
I'm saying I was making a little bit of a pun there. In your book...
Oh, no, the book, I didn't try and really go after anybody as far as having something scandalous and scurrilous. I tried to put in a lot of fun stories.
So, without any further ado or a don't, let's hear some stories from the book Hollywood Stories. Let's start with some of the serious actor type people. I keep mentioning Marlon Brando. Tell us a Marlon Brando story or two.
Okay, when Marlon Brando, when he made the movie Superman in 1978, by that time he was a little bit lazy, and even though he was getting paid quite a bit of money, he didn't really want to show up, and so he suggested to the producers that he just do a voiceover and something can stand in his place, and they said, well, what would stand in your place? And he said, well, how about a green bagel? You know, nobody knows what Kryptonians look like. For all we know, they could look like green bagels. And the producers thought it was funny, but they were also a little bit alarmed, and they said, come on, Marlon, your son's being played by Christopher Reeve. I mean, you have to look human. So he said, oh, all right. He was kind of kidding around anyway. So he was on screen for 10 minutes, made an estimated, it's anywhere from $14 to $19 million because he had partial ownership of the film, and he never bothered to learn his lines. And he had one scene where he was putting the future super baby on the spaceship and going to send it away from the doomed planet, and he was speculating on the baby's future, and he had the dialogue written on the bottom of the baby's diaper.
Why would he? What, was it just because he was mad, or mad as in crazy? Or did he want to stick it to the Holly? Did he not like the director? I mean, what was his rationale?
No, he just didn't want to learn his lines. He did the same thing in The Godfather. He had lines written all over the place. He made the movie The Missouri Breaks, It didn't matter with the director. Who the director was. It was just his style, but he changed when he made the Missouri Breaks that same year. He was making that with Jack Nicholson, and Jack Nicholson had so been looking forward to working with Brando, and then Brando didn't give him anything to work with because he was always looking at the cue cards. He never looked Brando. He never looked Jack Nicholson in the eye. So Jack Nicholson said, "Come on, Marlon, give me something." So Brando decided rather than use the cue cards, he still didn't want to learn the lines. He'd have an assistant in the trailer who would feed Brando the lines to a radio transmitter, and Brando would hear it through an earpiece. And the only problem was that the radio transmitter began to inadvertently pick up police broadcasts. So one time Brando was doing the scene, and he came out of character, and he looked startled, and he said, "Oh, my goodness, there's been a robbery at Woolworths."
And they really,
I don't think it had anything to do with the directors. I think it was because he just didn't always take the profession as seriously as he might have.
Which was it because he took this profession more seriously than anybody in the first 10 years.
Hi, Rabbi. I can't really hear you.
Ah, okay. I'll get close. See, this is what happens on the phones here. Can you hear me a little better now?
Yes, sir.
Oh, good. Okay. I'll shout, which is what I'm used to doing anyway. Now, what about a nice Jewish boy named Steven Spielberg, who was going to make a little movie, a little shark movie called Jaws, and you're saying that he really did not know whether or not the film worked or whether audiences would buy it. When did he know?
The movie took a lot longer than it probably he intended it to, because it was Spielberg's decision to film the movie in the middle of the ocean, because the Martha's Vineyard, because he wanted to turn the camera entirely around, and then the audience sees nothing but ocean, so there's no place to escape for the three shark hunters, so it would add to the suspense of the movie. Well, the problem was, and this is pretty famous, the mechanical shark didn't cooperate. It worked great in freshwater at Universal Studios, but when they put it in salt water, it got all corroded and sunk like a stone. And so the movie was delayed for months and months. That wasn't the only problem. There were weather problems and other boaters coming out, which nowadays could probably be removed by computer-generated technology. But back then, if you had another boater in the shot, then you had to move your boat to some other location, and then the shots didn't always match. So by the time the movie was finished, Spielberg was sick of the material and didn't know what he had. And they had a preview of Jaws in Dallas, and Spielberg was so nervous, he thought, "I might never work again," and he was standing up in the back of the theater, and about 18 minutes into the movie, the shark attacked its second victim. A man near the front row got up, ran up the aisle, ran past Spielberg, and Spielberg's thinking, "Oh, no, they're running out of my movie," and the man lost his meal. He threw up, couldn't even make it to the bathroom. It was on the lobby floor, and Spielberg said, "Oh, no, my movie is making people sick." And then the man cleaned himself up and resumed his seat. And for the first time in months, Spielberg relaxed, and he said, "If this man is sick and he still wants to see the end of this, I've got a winner on my hands." And that turned out to be absolutely right. Jaws, at the time, was the biggest hit ever, making over $100 million in 1975, and movie tickets at the time cost $2.
Wow. And I will say that, you know, I did my own live stage performance in New York just a couple of weeks ago, and I knew when people would leave the first or second row to go into the lobby and vomit, and then they would come back, I knew I had a hit on my hands. Happened every night, I'm telling you. So we're talking with Stephen Shohet, the
very
author.
Good. Well, Spielberg set a precedent for
puke.
Movies that are hits and make you vomit, I guess.
Well, a lot of the horror movies of that era, or even the late 60s, were delving in that as well. But let me ask also...
The Exorcist was actually 2 years before Jaws, and that was famous. Although The Exorcist was different from Jaws because it didn't get previewed. Because they were afraid of critical reaction, so they wanted to release it into the theaters before the critics got a shot at it. But Jaws was a little bit more traditional in that the critics saw it and mostly liked it. But The Exorcist made a lot of money before the critical word got out there.
Cool. We're talking with Stephen Shohet, the author of Hollywood stories. He's telling us some of the anecdotes, and there are many, many, many more in the book. So we're asking him just some of these wonderful stories about the people that we all know. Tell us a story about who almost was the Terminator.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, James Cameron, he had made a movie called The Attack of the Piranha, Piranha 2, The Spawn, and he was very disappointed by the quality of the movies he was directing, and he decided to go the Stallone route and write his own movie, and he came up with the idea of the robot from the future coming to the present and attacking people, and he thought, well, it won't cost that much. The studios won't balk at the budget because I could have a human actor playing the robot and film out on the street. And he sold the idea to Orion Pictures, and they had a lot of casting suggestions, which James Cameron didn't really like. And one of the casting suggestions was that Arnold Schwarzenegger could play the good guy Reese. And Cameron thought, Arnold Schwarzenegger, I saw him in Conan the Barbarian. He's so wooden. And so he decided to have lunch with Arnold Schwarzenegger and insult him during the lunch and break off the work relationship before it even started. And so they were there having lunch, and Cameron was thinking, oh, you know, I can't insult him. He's too nice. And look at those arms. He'd break me like a twig. And I didn't bring any money anyway, so Arnold's going to have to pay for the lunch. And he had a lovely time with Arnold. And at the end of the meal, he was thinking, you know, I can't see him as Reese, but I could see Arnold as the Terminator. It sure is better than the other stupid suggestion the studio made. I mean, who could imagine O.J. Simpson as a killer?
Absolutely.
And
O.J. Simpson
never
would have
been... did. Cameron never did have lunch with O.J. Simpson.
It's so a good thing,
that
too.
That idea didn't go anywhere.
Because that would have been a pain in the neck, literally. No, I don't know what that... I need my my rim shot thing going on. Let me ask you, there's also a cute story. Since, speaking of murder, Batman has been in the news in lots of different ways over the past couple of months. There's a very amusing little tale about Adam West and his acting companion on the TV show Batman and the Batpole. Please tell.
Yeah, I don't have that one in this book. I'm actually going to use that one in the second book because, this book I already have over 1,000 stories, and I had to pick a stop date, but... I'm always picking up new stories, and it was a story about Adam West and Burt Ward, and the way they used to change into Batman was that they would say to the Batpoles, and they'd be dressed up in their millionaire clothes or their normal clothes, and they would slide down the Batpoles, and they would land on a mattress, and then there would be a second shot which would show them sliding into the Batcave with the Batman and Robin outfit. So one time they said to the Batpoles, and they slid down 15 feet, and Adam West ended up landing on a wino who had somehow snuck into the studio and was sleeping it off. So it was quite an unusual encounter. They had a lot of interesting things on that show. Can I mention real quick that show at the time, despite Batman not being a very big-selling comic book in 1966, was one of the hottest things in Hollywood, and it gave an opportunity for a ton of actors who weren't getting as many movie roles to get some massive TV exposure, and practically everybody wanted to be on that show. In fact, Frank Sinatra was asking if he could play the Joker, and that didn't work out. At one point, Clint Eastwood was going to play Two-Face, but the series was canceled before that had an opportunity. And the only guy, as far as I know, who wanted nothing to do with the show was Spencer Tracy. And they offered the producers offered Spencer Tracy the role of the Penguin, and he said, I'll do it under one condition. I get to kill Batman. And it didn't work out.
Wow.
I do have a lot of Batman stories in the book, as a matter of fact, because the origins and the history is very interesting. And I just mentioned the Christopher Nolan, with these Batman movies. It's really interesting who he based the character of Batman on. The Christian Bale Batman was based on Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt, when he was young, he was very sickly, asthmatic. very weak. And then as a young man, he had a tragedy. On the same day, his mother died and his wife died.
Oh, yeah.
And he, according
I
to
hope
some
he put
people,
down the
suicidal,
gun.
And he went to the Dakota Badlands, trained himself, and became obviously a much fiercer, more physically fit guy. And then he became the New York police commissioner and used to ride his horse through the streets and slam people with a paddle. And he was the inspiration for this latest incarnation of Batman, although Batman obviously has been around since 1939, and he's been inspired by a lot of different things depending on who's guiding him, who's writing him, or who's directing him, or you know, who's in charge.
I have to ask, even going before we were talking about Batman, you were mentioning that great story I never heard about Spencer Tracy and his reaction to even being asked to be on the TV show. But do you have any Tracy or Hepburn stories or Bogey stories?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I do have a number of Tracy and, stories in the book and a number of Catherine Hepburn stories, and I think I only have one about them together, and it was, people might remember the movie The Aviator, where Howard Hughes had a bit of an argument with the Hepburn family. Well, Tracy used to get invited over to the Connecticut house, you know, in Fenwick, of the Hepburn family. And one night they were having this big argument about how to help the poor people, and Tracy just couldn't take it anymore. And he went out onto the porch to have a smoke, and he looked up and he saw this poor looking fisherman, apparently Mexican looking fisherman. And the man was on the Hepburn property, and he looked totally lost. And Tracy yelled inside, "Hey, better get another plate ready in there. The poor are here to collect." So old man Hepburn, Thomas Hepburn, Dr. Hepburn, he came out to the front porch, and he saw what Tracy was looking at, and he started yelling at the poor fisherman, "Hey, you get out of here. I'll sick the dogs on you." And the poor fisherman went running for his life, and Spencer Tracy was staring at Dr. Hepburn in astonishment, and Dr. Hepburn said, "I know what you're thinking, and you're absolutely right. We have to get the alarms fixed." And then the family went inside and resumed their discussion on how to help the poor.
Oh, that is so 99% 1%, isn't it? That's what a story. Thank you for sharing that. That's great. And any Humphrey Bogart stories?
Yeah. I got different stories about Humphrey Bogart. You know, with Casablanca, for example, it was an interesting time in his career. I mean, Jack Warner one time had referred to Humphrey Bogart as being ugly, and he was actually at the time losing his hair. Things were difficult with his wife, third wife Mayo. So he was lacking confidence when he was going up, going to be Ingrid Bergman's co-star in Casablanca and love interest. And he went to his buddies like Raoul Walsh and Peter Lorre, who co-starred with him in the movie, and he said, "How can I get the audience to believe that this beautiful woman loves me?" And what they advised him was to stay still, don't move, let her do all the work. And that's exactly how he played it, and I mean, it was very, very effective. Partly because of the way Ingrid Bergman acted, that she had this way of acting like she was always sort of studying her leading men's face and trying to read them, and it just came off so effective with so much chemistry. And from then on, Humphrey Bogart, who mostly, I mean, of course, he had played Sam Spade, but he had mostly played gangsters before that, was considered to be a sex symbol for pretty much for the rest of his life. And he was very surprised that happened. And I'll tell you, another person who was surprised about that whole movie was Ingrid Bergman, because when she was making that film, and this is kind of famous, she didn't know which one she was supposed to love, Humphrey Bogart or Paul Henry,
right?
She was told to play it in between, sort of, and she was more concerned at the time about getting the role in the movie For Whom the Bell Tolls, and she didn't think much of Casablanca, and then And then, of course, it won the Oscar, and she didn't really have a close relationship with Humphrey Bogart off camera. In fact, there are many stories that Humphrey Bogart's third wife, Mayo, who was kind of menacing, and they were fighting all the time, was standing behind the camera, keeping her eye on things to make sure things didn't get out of hand with Bergman. I mean, Bergman, fairly or unfairly, was at least accused of committing or having affairs with some of her leading men. And so anyway, she didn't want to talk about Casablanca, and for years she would talk about it with disdain, and she would say, oh, I had all these great roles, and all anybody ever wants to talk about is this thing I did with Bogart. And then in the 60s, the late 1960s, she, like a lot of actors in Hollywood from the 30s and 40s, started doing college retrospectives of their movies. And so she was at one university, and they showed Casablanca, and she watched it with an audience, possibly for the first time. And after the movie was over, she walked up to the podium for questions and answers, and she was a little bit dazed, and she was in a good mood, and she looked out at the audience and said, wow, that was a really good movie.
Wow. And it was the first time she truly stepped away from it and realized, you know, even I guess they don't even know when they're making it. You sometimes it takes the years or...
Boy, I'm sorry, Rabbi, I'm not hearing you.
Doesn't matter. We're talking with Stephen Shohet, who is the author of Hollywood Stories. It's available at hollywoodstories.com. Now, please explain something. This is a book. Is there a hard copy version of this? I also see on the website they mention an e-book and audio books. Could you explain all the things you're offering?
I have a hardcover and an e-book. I actually have two audio books, but they're different projects that I did earlier. One's called Tales of Hollywood, one's called Fascinating Walt Disney, but they're original audio books. I'm a tour guide in Hollywood, so that's how I started collecting all these stories to tell people on the tours, and then I had the idea the stories could be told anywhere. So my first project was the audiobook Tales of Hollywood. My second one was the audiobook Fascinating Walt Disney. And this is my third project. This is an actual print book, The Hollywood Stories, short entertaining anecdotes about the stars and legends of the movies. It's available in hardcover and in ebook.
Hardcover and ebook from Stephen Shohet, Shochet. If you're looking for the book at the website and on Amazon, of course, and the other places where you get books, actually. Now, before we get to some more celebrity anecdotes, I want to hear your anecdotes. I mean, how long have you been a tour guide in Hollywood?
About 20 years, and what happened was I was a writer. And I was a limousine driver because I could write while I was waiting for people in the limos, and then I was asked to give tours, and I found it very interesting, and I didn't know that much, but I knew a little bit, and I just said, well, I heard this anecdote, I heard that anecdote, just various things that I had come across, and it got a really good reaction, and so I decided to do it full time, but just because I thought it was more creative and interesting than being a limousine driver, at least from my perspective. And what I tried to do was, collect as much material as possible, and I still do, because the tour, you have to see the same things all the time, but the material, it's just unlimited pretty much. I mean, like, if you talk about the Chinese theater, for example, and you talk about Sid Grauman, I mean, he was a really wild character. He was a really interesting man, and he used to play these wild practical jokes. Like for example, he found out that Ernst Lubitsch, the director, was flying on an airplane from Los Angeles to Santa Barbara in 1933 for a movie premiere, and Lubitsch was terrified of airplane flying, and he asked Grauman to come along to keep him company, and Grauman played a practical joke. He hired a couple of stuntmen to dress up like airplane pilots and fly in the cockpit with the real pilots. So during the airplane flight, Grauman was trying to make Lubitsch as nervous as possible. And he said, look, Ernst, look out the window. Look at those beautiful jagged rocks below. And Lubitsch said, no thanks, and he lit up a big cigar. And the two phonies came out of the cockpit into the cabin. Mr. Lubitsch, Mr. Grauman, terrible news. The plane is running out of gas. And they jumped out with parachutes. And Lubitsch ended up swallowing the cigar and fainted and luckily recovered from a mild heart attack. I don't tell that story every tour because I try and get enough stories where I could vary it up and keep it fresh and keep up with the modern people, the modern stars, too, because there's always stuff going on in Hollywood. So try and have it be a combination of vintage and modern people can find out I do speaking engagements. If people would like to, a day full of stories, they can find out at hollywoodstories.com, and I do private tours and try and branch out and keep it fresh, both in the material and in what I'm doing.
Stephen, can I ask you, have you had close encounters of a celebrity kind?
Yes, numbers of them. I'll tell you a story. When I was before I became a tour guide, when I was a limousine driver, I drove a wonderful man, Sammy Davis Jr., and he was just really, really nice. I didn't drive him that far, but he sat in front with me, easy to talk to. But right before I picked him up in his house in Beverly Hills, I was talking to his security guard. And I was waiting outside. I said, is Sammy a nice man? And the security guard told me a story that he had six celebrity clients, and he had broken his leg, and he had no security, job security, being a security guard. He was a freelancer. And he didn't know where his next paycheck was coming from. And so he got out of the hospital and he went to the mailbox and he's thinking, oh, these unpaid bills, what am I going to do? And he opened the mailbox and the checks from Sammy Davis Jr. had never stopped coming. And Sammy never said a word about it. And he said, now I only work for him. He's such a wonderful man. And so I said, that's great. And I noticed there was a plaque by Sammy's front door and it said, this house welcomes anyone with peace and love and brotherhood in their hearts. And I said, oh, that's so nice. And the security guard said, well, confidentially, if anybody climbs over that fence with peace, love, and brotherhood in their hearts, I'm going to shoot them dead.
Well, you can tell Sammy was only half Jewish if he had a plaque like that, let me tell you.
Well, he was, I only had a brief encounter with him, but he just seemed like just a wonderful, easygoing, really nice guy. The only sad thing was when I saw him that, he was walking with a cane. He just had a hip operation, and for somebody who made his living the way he did, to not be able to dance, I'm sure was a frustrating thing. And then, of course, only about a year later, he died of throat cancer, so... I have stories about the whole Rat Pack, actually, but Sammy's the only one that I met. And then Lucille Ball, I used to see her all the time, and James Stewart and George Burns.
Did you talk to them? Did they just wave or?
A word I don't want to use, but I've seen a lot of people on the tours as well. Jack Nicholson, Johnny Depp, different people. And I'll tell you, it was really nice. Was Zsa Zsa Gabor, and there used to be a store called Fred Heyman's on Rodeo Drive, and unfortunately it's no longer there. But she actually met my customers at Fred Heyman's one time and took pictures with everyone, and I just was a really big fan of hers, and she's still alive and not in the best shape, so I'm sorry to read about that. But, one of the things about Zsa Zsa Gabor was she always went with Bob Hope to entertain the troops. Bob Hope was turned down by a lot of different stars because of difficult working conditions sometimes, going into combat zones and things like that. But Zsa Zsa Gabor, anything she could do for the troops, she would do. And they had the running gag where they come out on stage and Bob Hope would say, Zsa Zsa, is it true you don't have any domestic skills at all? And she said, what are you talking about, Robert, darling? I'm a great housekeeper. Every time I get the divorce, I keep the house.
That's a good line. That's very good. By the way, I need to tell everybody, it is 11:01 in the morning, Mountain Time. We're at the University of Northern Colorado doing the radio program Dave's Gone By, which airs 10 until 1 in the afternoon on Saturdays, every Saturday on uncradio.com. I happen to be Rabbi Saul Solomon and very excited to be talking to Stephen Shohet, the author of Hollywood Stories, where he's telling all these wonderful anecdotes about famous movie legends, legends that we all know about, but maybe we don't know some of the funny, bizarre stories that they had in their lives. And I really also want to talk especially about the comedians, because I'm fascinated by them, and you have such wonderful tales of them. So give us some stories about the great comic actors and comedians of times gone by.
Sure, I'll tell you a story about Bob Hope. Of course, he entertained 11 presidents, and the first one, of course, was President Roosevelt. And it was in 1944, just before Roosevelt finished his fourth term, which of course was on his fourth term, which he didn't finish, but for his fourth election victory, which of course will always be unprecedented. And so there was this crowd of luminaries, and Bob Hope was telling the story about there was a serviceman, a Marine, who was very disappointed that during the war he hadn't yet killed an enemy combatant. So he went to the edge of the jungle and yelled out, "To hell with Roosevelt!" And a Japanese soldier came out of the jungle and said, "Oh yeah." Oh, wait, I'm telling the story wrong. He said, "To hell with Hirohito, excuse me." And a Japanese soldier came out and said, "Oh, yeah, to hell with Roosevelt." And the Marine lowered his weapon and said, "Darn it, I can't shoot a fellow Republican." And Roosevelt, Bob Hope said that Roosevelt laughed so hard that he almost considered voting for him.
That's great. That's what.
And I'll tell you a story about the very first story in my book. It was a story a man actually told me on the tour. The day before he went on my tour, he had taken his family up to Universal Studios, and they were going by where Alfred Hitchcock made the movie Psycho. So the tour guide was talking about the movie and how they filmed it, and all of a sudden, a man came out from behind the Bates Motel with a wig and a dress and a knife. And everybody was laughing, Norman Bates in drag. And the tour guide says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know who this man is, and he's not part of the tour." And so now everybody's kind of alarmed, they're wondering what's going on here. And so this Norman Bates lookalike guy comes running toward the tram, yelling and screaming, and he raises the knife, and people on the tram started screaming, and he took off the wig, and it was Jim Carrey. He was making the movie up there, The Man on the Moon, and he had a little downtime, and he decided to scare everybody half to death. And then the nice part of the story was that afterwards he took pictures and signed autographs.
Do you know why gun control is important? Gun control is important in America because Jim Carrey would be dead right now if we didn't have it. You know, people like that who think these things are so amusing. It's just like, you know, back in the day. But tell us some more.
Do you know, he wasn't the first person to do that. You know who used to do that at the very beginning of the Universal Tours was the cast of McHale's Navy. Ernest Borgnine, Tim Conway, they would dress up as natives and run out behind the bushes with spears because that show was filmed at Universal Studios. And one time a lady got so scared she fell out of the tram, and the orders came from above that they better stop doing that.
Oh, my God, that's hysterical. More comedians, people like you have a story. I love this story, and it's a little surprising to me because I only learned recently that Charlie Chaplin, who I always thought was Jewish, was apparently not Jewish. He did The Great Dictator, he did The Thing, but now there isn't a Jewish bloodline in Charlie, unfortunately, alas. But there's something very Jewish about the story of Charlie Chaplin and Jackie Vernon. Could you tell that, please?
Yeah, it was Jackie Vernon really admired Charlie Chaplin, like so many comedians did. He was the hero, for Chaplin, and for years he sent him all these letters after Chaplin was sort of kind of exiled, I guess, to Switzerland, or, you know, he chose to move to Switzerland too. But anyway, what happened was is that finally he never got a reply on any of the letters, and finally he said, well, I'm going to stop sending them. So anyway, it was one morning in the 70s, and Jackie Vernon happened to be in London, and he went into this restaurant, and he sees, of all people, Charlie Chaplin. I mean, it's flesh and blood. You know, Charlie Chaplin's in a wheelchair, and things weren't, he didn't have that much longer to go. He passed away in 1977. But Vernon, he walked up to the table, and he said, Mr. Chaplin, I've always admired you and wanted to meet you. My name is Jackie Vernon. So the old man repeats the name thoughtfully. He says, Vernon, Vernon. So why did you stop writing?
Love that. I don't know why I love that story, but I just do it. So he doesn't bother to reply to the letters, but then he's like, oh, you stopped writing. Why'd you do that? I know. I love that. Tell us.
Right. Well, he was definitely a character, you know, and that's the whole thing. You know, there's another story, and let me say, some of the stories in the book, I call the book a mixture of biography, history, and lore. And so some of the stories, I have to say, they could be apocryphal. And I try and tell the reader, you know, that they might be apocryphal. But there's one story about a young soldier who went and saw a Charlie Chaplin movie. Around 1917, he said, oh, this little man is amazing. He's a subversive. He kicks authority figures in the rear, and yet the audience isn't threatened by him. Why is that? It's the mustache. The mustache makes him seem like a harmless clown. You know, I'm going to grow a mustache like Charlie Chaplin, and that way people will trust me, thought Adolf Hitler.
Oh,
and
I wonder.
I'll tell you, one of the interesting things about the history of Hollywood was that it was helped greatly by World War One, because World War One, during that time, the European film industry pretty much came to a halt, and the American film industry started traveling around the world. And since most of the movies were being made in L.A., that's when L.A. really started to become more of a boom town because of the growth of the movie industry, because of the worldwide distribution. And you look at the silent film stars. I mean, again, it's a disputed thing, but like Charlie Chaplin, Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, making about $1 million a year, although Mary Pickford did dispute that number at one point, but that was what was being reported. And to put it in perspective, the average house in L.A. costs $2,000. So the fact that the silent films, their stories traveled so well, they had worldwide understanding, led to them getting enormous salaries and Hollywood becoming a major business and a major player on the worldwide stock market and getting tons of people to move out here and try and become part of that business.
Let me ask Stephen Schohat, we only have a couple more minutes, but I there are a couple more wonderful stories I would love for you to tell about the comedy people, and they're all in your book, Hollywood Stories. First of all, the Three Stooges, tell us about that relationship between Moe and Larry.
Yeah, it's a real interesting relationship that they had, the Three Stooges, because they were different people. Now, of course, there were only two Stooges, unfortunately, that were consistent the whole time, because the other ones passed away. The Curly of course had heart problems, and Shemp all of a sudden just shocked everybody and just died out of the blue, whereas Curly was sick for a long time. And then you had Joe and Curly Joe, and Joe Besser didn't like to get hit, and Curly Joe came later when they were doing more features and less shorts. But the interesting thing was the relationship between Moe and Larry, whereas Moe was workaholic and a bit nervous a lot, Larry was like a carefree, happy-go-lucky guy. And the interesting thing was that Mo was extremely well-to-do because he invested his money very wisely and was a homebody, a family man, whereas Larry was a gambler and just gave away money and forgot about it and then borrowed money from Mo would forget about that, paying him back. Larry would be constantly undependable when it came to doing scenes because he was always listening to the Dodgers on the radio, and his wife Mabel didn't like to do housework, so they spent a lot of times in hotels in Atlantic City, and Larry at one point estimated that he went through $10 million. And so when they finished their shorts, because the Stooges, they made shorts from 1933 to 1958 at Columbia Pictures, and the head of Columbia, Harry Cohn, just loved them, but they got a maximum salary of $60,000 a year divided by three. And once they got that salary, they never got a raise. And they were a little bit afraid to ask for a raise because by that time in the 50s, Laurel and Hardy and Abbott and Costello and the Marx Brothers were pretty much doing features only. Laurel and Hardy had previously done shorts. And none of the studios were doing any shorts except for Columbia and the Three Stooges. So when they finished, Mo was planning to travel, and he was rich. And Larry was completely broke and planning to manage apartment buildings. And there was an element in Mo that thought, serves him right. You know, he wasted all his money. He never listened to me. But also, Mo remembered that when Curly was sick and unable to work, that Larry had voted that Curly still get a full share. And Mo was deeply touched by that because, of course, Curly was Mo's brother and Larry wasn't. And so Mo started looking out for Larry and making sure that he still had work. And, of course, then the Three Stooges movie started showing on TV, and suddenly there was a demand for them to keep having the live appearances. But you know, despite the fact that Mo was rich and Larry was poor, Mo stayed the nervous wreck all the time, and Larry, even when he moved into the motion picture home for aged actors, really kept his carefree attitude.
That's wonderful. I love that story, and we have time for one more last story from Larry Shohat. I want you to tell us.
I'm saying we
have time for one more story from Stephen Shohat. Please, everybody, his book, as you've been hearing for the past 40, 45 minutes, is Hollywood Stories, short, entertaining anecdotes about the stars and legends of the movies. You can get that at HollywoodStories.com. That's also a great place to learn about Stephen and his tours and his life and his ebooks. I want to thank you, first of all, for being such a fun and informative and delightful guest on Dave's Gone By. I think it's just wonderful listening to you. I could listen for another hour to all the stories that you have, but please end this with a story, a happy, nice story about, of all people, W.C. Fields.
You asked me for a story about W.C. Fields?
Yeah, there's a really nice story in the book about Fields.
Yeah, was it the Christmas story, I think, where W.C. Fields, he goes into the he's at a train station at Christmas time, and he was 15 years old, and the manager for the vaudeville act that he had been part of had taken all the employees' money and had run off, and so he was stranded out there. And he said, how much for? He walked up to the ticket window and said, how much for the train ticket to get back to Philadelphia? And the man said $10, and Fields didn't have anywhere near that kind of money. So he said, I see, and he sat down. And the man said, you're an actor, aren't you? And he goes, yes. And he goes, well, that's a tough profession sometimes, isn't it? He goes, yes, it is. And the man said, here, son, I'll tell you what, it's Christmas. I'm going to buy you the train ticket. And Fields started crying, and the man said, pay me back when you can. And so Fields was just so moved. And 2 years later, he paid the man back. He had absolutely no money, and because he sent the man $10 and another $10 in gratitude, and because of that, Fields ended up spending that Christmas 2 years later in a soup kitchen.
Wow, isn't that just it's an amazing? And of course, maybe 3 years later, Fields were going to be able to pay him back triple without even thinking about it. But back then, it was. I like that. I like that story a lot. And I like the book a lot, Hollywood Stories by Stephen Shohet. Stephen, thank you. Happy High Holy Days to you. Best of luck
you
with
too,
the
Rabbi.
Book.
Thank you so much for having me as a guest.
It was just a delightful. Have a great day and a great holidays. Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
Thank you.